This message today is got a little something in it for everyone. Not saying you're going to be terribly happy, but then should we be? Sometimes a self-analysis is perhaps a good thing. The title for today's message is, It Wasn't St. Nicholas. And that will become relevant as we get into this message. But it's about how God's elect are effectively disempowered. And I think that'll be obvious as we consider this topic. There are traditional ecclesiastical structures that inhibit people's spiritual development. We run into those all the time. It's a thing called Nicolaitanism and a related phenomenon called Laodiceanism. The church through history has dealt with persecutions, first empirical Rome, and then religious Rome. Today, we exist without that condition all that much. What we do, we're doing to ourselves. But there's two basic phenomena in our genre, and that will be the Nicolaitan effect and the Laodicean effect. And it's not peculiar to us. It's common in religions all over the world, within and without, and especially in what we recognize as hierarchical religions. But the Nicolaitan condition is not a well-defined term. I remember being given guidelines for doing a sermonette many years ago, one of which was discussing this matter of Nicolaitanism. It was suggested that had to do with people keeping Christmas, if you can imagine that. Why would they make that connection? Well, because of this fellow called St. Nicholas. I mean, there really was a St. Nicholas in the early church. Now, he was in the early 400s A.D., but that doesn't seem to matter all that much. But they want to make this connection with Nicolaitanism being Christmas observance. Why would they even consider that? Well, simple reason. It's an easy distraction away from what it really is. That's why. Those religious organizations that are Nicolaitan don't want it to be obvious. That's why the distraction. So they identified St. Nicholas to obfuscate the obvious. But keep in mind, at the time this was written, this is talking about the book of Revelation, which wasn't written until about the middle 90s A.D., the phenomenon of Christmas hadn't been invented yet as far as the church was involved. Now, they did borrow many of the customs and ideas from Saturnalia, which was a long-standing Roman observance, but that isn't really what it's talking about. It's talking about something else, and that's what we need to consider. Let's go to the passage of Scripture that talks about this, and it's found in Revelation chapter 2, and it's related to what we consider the Pergamos era of the church. Revelation 2, beginning verse 12. And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things says he which has the sharp sword with two edges. I know your works. Didn't Coy just refer to that? I know your works and where you dwell, even where Satan's seat is. And you hold fast my name and has not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr who was slain among you, where Satan dwells. So these were faithful people as far as the teachings were concerned, but there was another factor playing in here. And in verse 14, he becomes corrective. But I have a few things against you, because you have there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam. So certain doctrines were creeping in, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication. But also you have those among them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. Repent, or else I'll come unto you quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He has some serious things to say to these people who embrace the doctrine and the deeds. It refers to both of these Nicolaitans. Who were they anyway? That's important to know. And what exactly was happening here? There was a fellow, and it's interesting, I heard his name mentioned at that presentation that we went to last week with the other group. They mentioned the name of this fellow, Marcion. Marcion was an important leader in the early church. But in time, he became recognized as a heretic. He was disfellowshipped. And he went on to create his own following. From the internet, you can find something like this. He was from the early second century. He was eventually declared a heretic. He rejected the Old Testament and most New Testament except Paul's epistles, and even those subject to gross misinterpretation. Marcion's teachings departed from traditional Christianity in a number of ways. Most dramatically, Marcion rejected the idea that the Old Testament God and the New Testament God were the same being. The early church understood that. We understand that. But he took issue with that. Up until then, the traditional church had considered the Old Testament to be sacred and assumed that Christianity was a fulfillment or continuation of Judaism. Marcion's rejection of that idea affected many different doctrines and beliefs. He had considerable influence. Even though being disfellowshipped, even though being declared a heretic, he had considerable numbers of people who followed him. But this next part is even more important. For all we know, Marcion may have developed his theories long before he came to Rome. This much we know, that the views of Marcion spread rapidly over the whole world. Marcionite churches sprang up, splendidly organized, with their own bishops and the rest of the ecclesiastical discipline, with a cult and service of the same nature as those of what subsequently became the Catholic Church. Do you see what Marcion brought in? He brought in the ecclesiastical structure of clergy versus laity that persists in most religions to this day. That was the problem. And that, we could say, is perhaps the best definition of Laodiceanism that you could find. This was the problem. This is what God hated. But why did he hate it? Isn't it a good thing to have church organization? Sure. I mean, any church group that exists has the right to administer itself. It has a right to have people in charge who know what's going on and who to prevent things that shouldn't be going on. Yes. But there's another component entirely, and that is where the so-called clergy can dictate what is taught. And as we've seen in our own personal experience, when that clergy becomes in control, they can steer doctrines away from what they ought to be. And this is what concerned God the most when that kind of situation develops. What is Nicolaitanism? By its own definition, by the word itself, keep in mind, Christmas observance hadn't taken root in the church that early. They would have recognized Saturnalia for what it was. The early church wouldn't have even remotely accepted the thing that we today call Christmas as an observance. So that's not what it was. And we shouldn't consider that as a distraction, as so many have. It's structured organizations who want to misdefine this term, and for obvious reasons. But the thing is to understand the effect that it has on our religious genres, and that is all of the like belief systems in our particular belief system. Many are affected by this very same situation. In Ephesians 4, verse 11, where it says, "And he gave some apostles, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers." Now, the typical view of that is this is a ranking structure. And that's what gives impetus to the idea of clergy versus laity. We have a familiarity with that. We've experienced it in the past. Apostles, prophets, evangelists, teachers. One more reference. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 12 before we leave this. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 28. "And God has set some in the church, first apostles, secondarily prophets, thirdly teachers, after that, miracle workers and so on, gifts of healings, governments, diversities of tongues, and on down the line." Is this talking about a ranking structure? Because that is easy to see being the case. The Nicolaitan approach would make these be orders or ranks of authority, let's say, the apostle being the top-ranking person in the church, the prophet being subordinate to him, and the evangelist subordinate to the prophet, and both of them subordinate to the apostle, and so on. This is the picture that has been presented in many, many churches throughout the world, not just our own. Many churches operate from that position or that idea. Are these really authority structures? What is an apostle anyway? Now keep in mind, in the early New Testament church, there were no less than 17 apostles all at once, all at the same time. We know the 12. Christ is called an apostle and high priest of our faith. The apostle Paul was an apostle. There's 14 right there. And there's three others that are named apostles. What is an apostle? By the very definition of the word, it's someone who is sent out. It's not someone in the inner office who has authority over all the others. This is someone who is sent out. Sent out where? Into the world. They're sent out to be an emissary to those people who never heard the truth before. They work virgin territory. They're not over the congregations. They are operating in advance of the congregations outside. They're sent out into unevangelized areas, people who are unfamiliar with the Word or with God or His truth. That's the important thing to understand. Now, they can be sent out by God directly. Certainly Paul was. They can be sent out by the congregation. But they're people who are sent out. They're not people who are in charge of everything below them. And then we have a prophet. A prophet is someone who proclaims the truth. And someone who prophesies of future events. Now, we prophesy, but based on the word, we know things are going to happen. It's written that it's going to happen. That would be a prophet. Where does a prophet stand in a ranking structure? It's not really related to a ranking structure. It's a job assignment to people who have a particular proficiency. And we have an evangelist. What is an evangelist? Is an evangelist someone who is subject to a prophet? An evangelist is a motivational speaker. He's not necessarily tied to any particular congregation. I mean, he can be of a congregation. He can have a home area. But an evangelist is someone who goes out and motivates people among present and potential converts. And then it names the fourth thing in that progression, a teacher. Who is a teacher? A teacher can be anyone with knowledge and who shares it with others. A person doesn't need to be ordained a teacher. I don't know that that's even done. I haven't run into that. A teacher is anyone who knows the truth and who knows it well enough and who is correct in his ideas at least, who can share what he knows with other people. Each of us are teachers among those that we interact with. We give them an example, hopefully, and when the opportunity arises, we give them the word now and then. A teacher. In Hebrews 5:12, we're told that after so long in the church, you ought to be a teacher. Let's go there. That's interesting. Because this isn't often encouraged by the so-called clergy. They want to keep certain things to themselves. But in Hebrews chapter 5, where he says, "For when, for the time," in other words, after all this time, "you ought to be teachers, but you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not strong meat. For everyone that uses milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil." Do you see the situation? Paul is admonishing these long-term attendees that after all this time, after all you've heard, you ought to be, to some degree at least, a teacher. It's not something that's reserved to the clergy. Okay? If you have the talent, and not everyone does, not everyone's the same, but if you have the skill, if you have the knowledge, if you have the opportunity, you ought to be teaching to what degree you can. Paul is chiding these people for not being what they ought to be. And he's saying it to us just as well. Then again, we have people who desire to be teachers, but really shouldn't be because they have many false ideas. That's something else we need to be careful about. 1 Timothy 1:7 talks about that condition. 1 Timothy 1:7, starting verse 6. From which some, having swerved, have turned aside unto vain jangling, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say, nor whereof they affirm. That can happen. That's where the congregation comes into play. The congregation needs to monitor what's going on, what's being taught, and to steer things in a right direction. The congregation has a responsibility to oversee the affairs of their own congregation. That's something else that's taught in the New Testament. Now, that could be a separate topic, but the people have a responsibility to be involved mentally and theologically with the overall conduct of what's going on. So that's important. But the Nicolaitan factor is that structure over the congregations, over the so-called laity, where they effectively prevent what needs to happen from happening. They want to be in charge of everything. I remember early on attending the first few months that I began attending back in Massachusetts. We were admonished, don't ask any questions among yourselves. Ask your question to the minister. Okay, well, fine. Being brand new is probably good advice. But forever, we don't talk about the things of God among one another. What about that Malachi 3:16 passage where we need to speak often one to another? About what? The latest score? What happened down the street? Car hit a pole or something? What do we talk about one with another? God, when he hears his name, he overhears that conversation. So it's things that have to do with God. That's what he's asking us to do as individuals, speaking often one to another. Now, what does Nicolaitan mean? I've kind of laid that out, but let's come to understand the term for what it is. The Greek word for Nicolaitans, and that's Strong's Concordance number 3531, found in Revelation, is actually three words combined. As a proper noun, it transfers without being translated into English. It's what we call transliterated. The three Greek words are nikos, laos, and ton. The first Greek part of the English word, Nicolaitans, nikos, we use the English equivalent instead of the Greek letters, as we shall also of the other two. Nikos is often defined as a conquered people. Victory, triumph. The conquered, and by implication, those who are dominant over the defeated. A nikos is a conqueror. Someone who conquers, and who do they conquer? Next word. The middle part of the word, Nicolaitans, is the Greek laos. This word means people. It also is in Nicholas, which transfers and composes into Nikolaos. This means one who is victorious over the people. Do we get the picture here? And keep in mind, God says he hates this. Well, if he does, shouldn't we? A still further transferred use of Laos is found in the name Laodiceans, Strong's Concordance number 2994, compounded with Dicant or Dicey. The last part of the word in question is ton. It is contracted into a long A, thus making the word tan, which is the genitive case plural in all of the genders. The definite article the. We therefore have, without the legal Greek construction, the English hyphenated word nikos leos ton, but which, with its lawful contractions, becomes the English translation found in Revelation. In its ecclesiastical setting, Nicolaitans means the bishops and prelates of the church having gained a triumphal victory or conquest over the laiton, the laity. Members are compelled and forced to submit to the arbitrary domination of men who have become that thing which God hates. So we can get the picture. Nicolaitanism is a problem. But what kind of a problem is it? Let's look at 1 Peter 5, verses 1 through 3. Peter addresses this situation indirectly. He says, "The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed, shepherd the flock of God." He's speaking to the ministry. "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain," and that would include power as well, "but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock." Do you get a different picture there? Does that sound like a Nicolaitan circumstance? Not really. That brings us to the other word, Laodicean, the final church addressed in Revelation chapter 3. What is a Laodicean? Because there's strong language there, too. He doesn't praise those people. And what does he not praise them for? In the Laodicean condition, it's not what the leadership might be doing. It could be a result, an indirect result of what the leadership is doing, but it's not what the leadership themselves are doing. What it has to do is the prevailing spiritual attitude among the congregations, and for that matter, it's in society too. Our society is as Laodicean as you can get, but not in a religious sense necessarily. But the prevailing spiritual attitude. They're lukewarm in their devotion to their underlying calling. Now, Laodicean has been defined. And in researching this, just actually this morning, I came to realize it isn't just a matter of making a decision. The way we looked at this in the past when we identified those Laodiceans over there, I mean, we were the Philadelphians, I mean, after all, that you had those Laodiceans and other people. Interesting thing about that. Rod Meredith one time, well, I don't know about one time, but he regarded UCG as being Laodicean. Why? Because they voted on their ministerial appointments. You know, see, to him, his fault was the people did decide. When you read the intent of God, what God says about Laodiceans, he is urging them to decide. It wasn't that they were decisive. It's they were indecisive. They were lukewarm. They're neither hot nor cold. The problem was they weren't doing what they should be doing, making decisions that should have been made. Now, Leo, you know, the Leo part we recognize that that's referring to the laity. But the Nicene part, what is that talking about? It's actually a reference to, and it's oblique reference to, achieving justice. Achieving justice. This is where they were inadequate. They weren't doing what they should have been doing to achieve a justice. They were lukewarm about anything. Didn't really want to fix things. They didn't really want to do stuff. They just wanted to move on and let it be. God faulted these people for being lukewarm. Lukewarm in their devotion to their underlying calling. When God calls someone, he expects that they're going to use what they're given, which would involve the receipt of his Spirit, to use what they were given in pursuit of doing the job that he's called them to do. And that is to be a part of his growing family, the congregations, the churches. No, instead, people want to turn it over to the hierarchy. They want to turn it over to the clergy. Let them do the brain work. Let them do the thinking. Let them do the teaching. We'll just sit and be entertained with what we're hearing. Keep in mind, in Revelation 3:16, lukewarmness is a formula for rejection. He is going to reject certain people. And for what? For the simple thing that they haven't done what was required of them. In Isaiah 30, verse 10, there's an interesting picture here of how people are. This was true back then. It's even more so today, particularly in the Protestant world. Not just our folks, but especially the Protestant world. If you've ever listened to Osteen, you'll know what I'm talking about. But in verse 10 it says, which say to the seers, these are supposedly the people who are aware of what's going on, which say to the seers, see not, don't see what you really see. See not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us, write things. Speak unto us smooth things. Prophesy deceits. Get you out of the way. Turn aside, out of the path. Cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. They're not presenting God's word for what it says. That's how people want it to be sometimes. And what a rotten shame, but that's what people want. But that's how it is. People want to fund their leadership. And they want their leadership to present to them what they want to hear. They want their leadership to rule over them, and they love it that way. It makes life easier. People are content, okay, to let the clergy do what God calls every one of us to do, being involved ourselves to oversee our circumstances, to make corrections where corrections need to be made. But then there's another factor, and that's in 1 Corinthians 3. The first three chapters are focused on this particular phenomenon, but verses 1 through 4 of chapter 3, where Paul is saying similar things to what he said to those in Hebrews 5 about, after all this time, you ought to be teachers. Well, here's another component, and here's what else happens. And I, brethren, could not speak unto you as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal, even as unto babes in Christ. Remember that part? I have fed you with milk and not with meat. For hitherto you were not able to bear it, neither yet now are you able. What's the problem? Verse 3, for you are yet carnal. For whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are you not carnal and walk as men? For while one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not carnal? Who then is Paul? And who then is Apollos? But ministers by whom you believed, even as the Lord gave to every man. You see what's happening? People were making favorites of their favorite leader. They were looking to their favorite leader. They weren't looking to who they were representing. But Paul identifies it, and you can read these entire three chapters, and you'll see Paul is identifying this situation as carnality. Then we have another factor, and here's where these two situations cross over. They actually are interrelated. You see, Nicolaitanism gives us reason to rationalize Laodiceanism. You see how that happens? Nicolaitanism is suppression from without. Laodiceanism is lethargy from within. Now, we're told we ought to grow in grace and knowledge, and we certainly should. But when we submit to Nicolaitanism, do we really do that? When we take the Nicolaitan approach, do we really do that? Do we really grow in grace and knowledge? And people don't really understand the full implication of what that's saying. We can understand growing in knowledge. How do you grow in grace? Because we look at grace as an incoming phenomenon, when in fact we are to express it ourselves. We're to express grace ourselves. We're to grow in grace, and grace in the sense of expressing it to other people. It's not just incoming. It needs to be outgoing as well. What if Nicolaitanism and Laodiceanism were operating in the same general vicinity, in the same congregations? What would it be like? We could call it Nicolaodicean. Okay? Can you imagine how that could happen? Oh, wait a minute. We've seen it, haven't we? What are we going to do?